From heart rates to crime, this is the Perpetual Notion Machine for Thursday, May 11th, 2017. I'm your host, Will Cushman. So we hear a lot about crime in America these days. Crime rates, criminal justice, crime prevention. But what causes crime? Sure, social factors definitely play a role, but what can biology tell us about crime and who might commit it? Tonight's guests study these questions. Olivia Choi and Adrian Rain are researchers at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. They recently published a paper in the Journal of Criminology that links resting heart rates to criminality. It sounds kind of wild, I know, but their research shows a relationship between specifically low resting heart rates and a propensity toward crime. The research supports similar findings from around the world and has potential implications for public health and law enforcement. It could also partly explain the gender disparities in criminal activity, men being more likely to commit crimes. It's a fascinating topic. I talked to Choi and Rain via phone from their lab in Philly. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Could you each just describe your background in criminology or just scientific research and how you became interested in your field?
Olivia, let's start with you.
So my name is Olivia Choi, and I'm in the Department of Criminology here at the University of Pennsylvania. But I'm starting a position at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore this July as an assistant professor. I actually did my undergrad, master's, and PhD in criminology, and I did psychology as an undergrad as well. So a lot of my research involves looking at the causes and treatment of antisocial and criminal behavior from biopsychosocial perspective. So that's looking at biological factors in conjunction with psychological and social factors to really get a better understanding of antisocial behavior and crime.
And Adrian, how about you?
Okay, and for me, I'm Adrian Rain. I'm professor in criminology, psychiatry, and psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. So you can see I'm a bit of a mixed bag of tricks, really. What got me into the field originally is I was an undergraduate, and I wrote quite a good essay on psychopaths and the biological basis of psychopathy. So I started off doing my PhD on the biological basis of antisocial behavior in schoolboys. Actually, one of the findings I had from my early PhD was that antisocial schoolboys have lower resting heart rates. Moved over eventually to the United States. As you can hear from me, I come from England. And let's see, I've been doing a broad range of research over the past few decades, but it's always focused on the biology of crime. So my work involves brain imaging, hormones, psychophysiology, neuropsychological functioning, genetics. And actually, through Olivia right now, we've been really doing more treatment intervention work, trying to change biology to see if that can change antisocial behavior. So for myself, I've been doing nutritional intervention work to try and upregulate the brain, to try and improve behavior in kids. And Olivia, your recent treatment work?
Yeah, we've been applying a form of non-invasive brain stimulation called transcranial direct current stimulation, which is really just this technique where you apply a very low-intensity current to the scalp, and theoretically then you can either upregulate or downregulate activity in a certain brain region. And because prefrontal brain impairments are one of the best replicated risk factors for antisocial behavior, what we're doing is testing whether upregulating the prefrontal cortex can reduce antisocial behavior.
What do you mean by upregulating and downregulating?
Upregulating means increasing activity in that brain region.
Cool. Could you describe the field of criminology and where your research kind of falls in the spectrum of all the research that goes on in that field?
Yeah, sure. Traditionally, criminology has really focused on studying sociological risk factors for crime. A lot of theories of crime stem from sociological perspectives with very little attention to biology, really. And so our research really tries to incorporate the biological perspective into, you know, into this social context to try to combine these biological perspectives as well as these more traditional sociological perspectives to understand crime.
Yes, I mean, criminology throughout its history has really focused on very broad social factors like bad neighborhoods and poverty and discrimination. And those factors are important, and you know, we from a biological perspective don't question that. But what we would say is that there's more to crime than that, and that there's another part of the equation, which really has been ignored traditionally by criminologists, and that's the biological part of the equation. Two sides to the coin here, put simply, the social side and the biological side. So what we've been doing, in a way, is, within criminology, turning the coin over to begin to take a look at the biological pieces that also go to make up the criminal offender. Biological research on crime is the exception rather than the rule. For example, you know, the largest meeting in criminology is the American Society of Criminology. It's held every November. And really, of all the papers that are presented there, there's only about 2% which are on biological factors. So that gives you an extent, Will, of the imbalance in research in trying to understand the causes of crime. And that's what Olivia and I are really trying to redress, to try and flesh out the causes of crime, because all the research out there says that really 50% of crime and antisocial behavior, it's genetic, or that there are genetic contributions to crime causation. And there's no question about that, that there's hundreds of studies now, twin studies, adoption studies, which have all documented that. So you see, if there's a genetic basis to half of crime, so to speak, then there have to be biological downstream effects of those genetic processes. And, you know, it shouldn't really be 2% of the papers at the American Society of Criminology talking about biological factors. It should really be 50% if we're going to have an accurate perception of the etiology of the causes of crime.
Right. And so I kind of want to dive into this latest research. So you conducted a longitudinal study, and you're considering resting heart rates in the potential relationship with criminality, and gender was a big factor in there. I guess, why resting heart rates? Adrian, you said that your initial research dealt with resting heart rates and its relationship to crime. Could you just describe the study, the community you chose, what, like all the decisions, or all the major decisions you made, and why you made them, and kind of what you were hoping to get out of the study and what you did get out of it?
Yes, well, all the decisions, there were many of them in a way. I'd just step back a second to give the background to the study. This is really a three-generation study, and I'm not talking about the participants, I'm talking about the experimenters here. So that my PhD supervisor, Peter Venables, set up this longitudinal study in Mauritius in 1972, where he studied every, you know, three-year-old kid born in two towns on the island. By the way, Mauritius is a tropical island in the Indian Ocean. And it was Mauritius because the World Health Organization wanted to set up a study on child development in a developing country. So it was really my supervisor who launched this study. And when he retired, I took over the study. And one of the things I was interested, of course, was criminal behavior, because I'd always studied antisocial behavior. Peter, my supervisor, had never done any work on antisocial behavior. So what I brought to that table is that I brought my interest in antisocial behavior. So I began to go about measuring crime in those children as they grew up, measured antisocial behavior, conduct disorder, like delinquent behavior. And then as they grew up, ultimately when they turned 23, I got a grant from the National Institute of Health to allow me to search all the district courts on the island to find out which individuals had become criminal. That was sort of my starting point. And as you remember, one of the findings from my own PhD was that for whatever reason, low heart rate seems to be associated with antisocial behavior in 15-year-old schoolboys. However, that was a cross-sectional study. I've got 15-year-old schoolboys, I'm measuring their heart rate. Yes, I do find that low heart rate is associated with higher levels of antisocial behavior in the schoolboys. But then we sort of move on a couple of decades, and now Olivia comes along, and she's the third generation here as my PhD student. And you take it from here, Olivia, about your interests, how you came into this, and what you've been doing on this study.
Yes, I've been doing some work on heart rate, and in a previous study, we found that social adversity early in life influences low heart rate to in turn predispose to antisocial behavior, for example. So I've always been interested in heart rate as a risk factor and how it can better explain a lot of the important phenomena we see in criminology. And so in this study, we really aim to employ a biological perspective to explain this well-documented finding, which is the higher rate of male crime compared to female crime. You know, this is something we see across time, you know, across cultures, across ages even. You know, we see gender differences in aggression, for example, as early as at 17 months of age. And so it seems that any encompassing theory of crime should help to explain these gender differences. But traditionally, criminology has focused on studying male crime. So a lot of classic theories that stem from sociological perspectives, as we talked about before, really were developed with very little concern for these differences. And they've been applied retrospectively to explain them, but they don't do, you know, a very good job at it. And so we tested whether a biological process like heart rate, and we actually looked at heart rate because low heart rate is arguably the best correlate of antisocial behavior. And this has been found through many, many studies since AGENT study and in meta-analyses. And so we looked at whether a low heart rate can help to explain these gender differences that we see in offending. So we took heart rate which is measured at age 11 in these children from Mauritius, and we tested whether that could account for the gender differences in crime that we see in adulthood. And what we found was that heart rate does partly account for these gender differences in adult crime, whether it's for violent crime or nonviolent crime.
Right. You also controlled for a bunch of other risk factors, right? So you found a difference in crime based on, or a relationship between resting heart rate and crime, even controlling for a bunch of other factors. Could you describe what those other factors were?
Yes. This is what we found in the study and also in many studies on the heart rate antisocial behavior relationship, that even after controlling for factors like height, weight, physical activity, race, we still see that low heart rate is associated with higher levels of offending.
What caught my attention here was I would have never thought that a resting heart rate would be at all linked to something like crime. Are there theories for what the potential relationship is, that, or what can kind of explain that relationship?
Yeah, well, there are two major explanations that have been proposed. One is the stimulation-seeking theory, the idea that individuals with low heart rate aim to seek stimulation to raise their levels of arousal to a more optimal level. And one way of doing that is through engaging in antisocial behavior. So these are behaviors that are stimulation-seeking. Of course, there are other stimulation-seeking activities like skydiving, for example, but antisocial behavior is another way of seeking stimulation. The other major explanation that has been proposed is the fearlessness theory. So that theory suggests that a low heart rate suggests or low level of fear in individuals, and these individuals with lower levels of fear may then be more likely to engage in antisocial behaviors because it really does require a degree of fearlessness to actually execute these acts.
Those are two sort of mainstream theories to try and explain the heart rate crime relationship, really. And, you know, in some ways, men are more fearless than women, aren't they? They're more likely to take risks. But what comes to my mind is, you know, this issue of self-control, which I remember Olivia mentioned in her paper. And what I'm reflecting on is a very large-scale study that came out of Sweden about 2 years ago by a researcher called Latvala, who I think was Finnish. It was a sample of 700,000 men who were aged 18, and their heart rates were assessed at age 18. And they were followed up to see which ones committed crime. And again, Latvala, you know, replicated the findings from many countries now, showing that, yes, the 18-year-old men with low heart rates are more likely to commit crime and violence later. But what was more interesting to me were two other findings he had. The second finding is that men with lower heart rates are more likely to be the victims of crime, not just to commit more crime and violence, but to be the victims of crime. The third finding he got is that men with low resting heart rates are more likely to have accidents and injuries. But what does this mean? You've got lower heart rate relating to committing more crime, being the victim of crime, and then having more accidents and injuries. What ties the three findings together is the whole idea that low resting heart rate is a marker or an indicator for not just the lack of fear, not just the stimulation seeking, but really a reckless disregard for your own safety. You know, because if you're lacking fear and you seek out stimulation, you're more likely to put yourself into a situation where you begin to associate with ne'er-do-wells and people who maybe are on the fringe of society and who are more likely to commit crime. If you are lacking fear and you have a reckless disregard for your safety, perhaps you're more likely to take risks and have accidents and injuries. So I found that a really intriguing study for lots of reasons, not just the enormous sample size of 700,000, but also the fact that there were this trio of findings that really, to us, at least to me and Olivia, made a lot of sense.
We should say that you found that the lower resting heart rate was associated with both violent and nonviolent crime, right? There wasn't really that much of a difference there?
Yes, in this case, we found that it was associated with both violent and nonviolent crime, as has been found in other studies as well. And I think that's really interesting, in particular, that we find that low heart rates partly account for the gender difference in both violent and nonviolent crime, because a lot of explanations from more traditional criminological theories that stem from those sociological perspectives have been proposed to be better at explaining minor delinquency rather than serious offending. And here we see that this biological process can partly account for both serious and less serious offending.
Yes, that's an interesting point, isn't it, Olivia, that it's really an across-the-board risk factor for all types of offending, and it's harder for some of the other sociological and social theories to really explain, you know, how we cut across different forms of antisocial behavior.
Yeah, and I think it really suggests that there's value in looking at non-social explanations.
Right. If we really want to understand, you know, what causes crime, we have to go beyond the traditional social explanation. So, you know, the traditional social psychological explanation is called differential socialization, which means that simply we bring up boys and girls differently. You know, we give little girls dolls and little boys guns.
Right.
And, you know, they're socialized to be different, that boys should be assertive and aggressive, and then girls should be caring and empathic. And, you know, and our research, I think, doesn't decry that explanation, but it adds to it. It says that's not the only explanation for why men and women differ in terms of crime.
So it sounds like these findings are supported by some of those other studies that you mentioned, or at least kind of generally in agreement. Was there anything that you were surprised by with your results?
Well, it's a good question, isn't it? What did surprise us, Olivia? Well, I'll tell you, one thing that comes to my mind is, as Olivia said, we looked at violent offending, non-violent offending. We also looked at drug offences too. And actually, can I ask you, Will, I mean, from what you've heard so far, what would you expect for drug offences? Would you expect to find a stronger effect, a weaker effect, or no effect? From what you know about drug effects.
I guess with my complete lack of expertise in the area, I would expect there to be a relationship, a similar effect as other crime.
Yep, and Olivia, your finding was?
Yeah, we do see that.
We did get the finding. In my look at the paper, it wasn't as strong as for violent offending. And I had thought that, you know, what do I know about drug offenders? I don't study drug offenders, but I might have thought that people who illegally take substances, they may be stimulation seekers. And that if the stimulation seeking theory is correct, I might have expected possibly even stronger findings for drug users. But there you go. Shows my lack of knowledge on drug addicts and the reasons why they do it. And there's probably reasons well beyond stimulation seeking to explain why they abuse drugs.
I'm sure there are.
So what qualifies as a low or high resting heart rate? And I guess, like, what... Say someone knows that they have a low resting heart rate, how concerned should you be about your potential to commit crime or your child's or whatever? I guess, like, how strong is the relationship?
That's a good question. I think it's always difficult to give an exact cutoff point. So, you know, in this study, when we're looking at the heart rate and antisocial behavior relationship, we're always looking at, you know, your relative heart rate compared to other people in the sample. Well, low heart rate is a robust, but it's also a modest correlate of antisocial behavior. So I think that's something to keep in mind as well. Obviously, biological factors, that's not the only part of the puzzle. There are also other sociological and psychological factors that come into play in explaining antisocial behavior. So it's not the entire story. It's not just that individuals with low heart rate will commit crime or... And that's just looking at biological factors. Here we're looking at one specific biological factor. So we just have to keep in mind that it's a modest correlate of antisocial behavior.
And I would add, really, that I view heart rate very much like height, weight, body mass index, blood pressure. Take, you know, what's high blood pressure? We say, right, it's 140 over 70, is it? 140 over 90? Okay, so 144... one measure at least. But really, it's arbitrary. It's an arbitrary cutoff, you know.
Right.
And I take heart rate that way. It's a question of degree. The higher, you know, the lower you are on heart rate, the more likely you are to be a risk taker, to be fearless, and possibly not just a perpetrator of crime, but a victim of crime. And also, of course, for men and women, it's different. As you know, men have got lower heart rates. I don't think people have to worry too much, as Olivia says. It's a risk factor. But the strength of the relationship is not enormous. And that's because there's many, many things that go to make a violent criminal offender. That they're like a jigsaw puzzle. Lots of different pieces. And heart rate is only one of them.
Right.
Socialization is only one of them. You know, and I think Olivia would agree with this. You know, it doesn't end with heart rate. There's obviously many factors that go to shape heart rate.
So how much is heart rate biological factor and how much of it is potentially like environmental based on your life experience?
Well, yeah, but heart rate is heritable, so I guess about 50%.
Yeah.
You know, we also found in a previous study, which has been replicated recently, that social factors can influence a biological factor like heart rate.
Gotcha.
So children who experienced social adversity early in life had lower heart rates at age 11, and that in turn predisposed to antisocial behavior.
So that's a finding that Olivia published in 2015?
Yeah.
Right? And there you go. I mean, a traditional finding in criminology is social adversity predisposes to antisocial behavior. But how? How does social adversity predisposed? What's the mechanism of action? So Olivia found evidence for heart rate as the mechanism of action, that being exposed to social adversity results in a lowering of a person's heart rate, which in turn is associated with the later development of antisocial behavior. So going back to one of your original questions, Will, what biological research bringing to the table on the criminological research? I think it's doing a better job of understanding, you know, long-standing relationships,
yeah,
like social adversity linked to crime, and understanding the mechanisms of action. And really, that's what we need to do.
Yeah, it's sort of filling in that missing link.
Mm-hmm, good way of putting it. Filling it in the missing link.
That makes a lot of sense. I kind of have one or two more questions. I guess it's like two kind of wrapped up in one. Where are you going next with your research? And what are some of the, I guess, practical implications that you can imagine for your research in the fields of law enforcement or healthcare, public health?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm continuing work on heart rate, and I'm also looking at some of my other research involves looking at the influence of nutritional factors on antisocial behavior. I'm interested in vitamin D, for example, and how that can be a protective factor. What that means is instead of looking at risk factors where, you know, a certain risk factor can increase the likelihood of engaging in antisocial behavior, I'm interested in looking at whether a nutritional factor like vitamin D can protect individuals from engaging in antisocial behavior. And I think understanding risk factors like low heart rate can help to inform future intervention programs as well. For example, prefrontal brain impairments, as I mentioned earlier, is a risk factor for antisocial behavior. So what we're doing then is, you know, using that knowledge on risk factors and seeing whether there are interventions that we can, or biological interventions that can help to reduce antisocial behavior based on that. So another aspect of my research is the work on non-invasive brain stimulation and treatment.
What I would add is that in terms of practical application, we have to make decisions, certainly in prisoners, about which ones are more likely to recidivate, which ones are more likely to come back to prison, versus which ones are less of a risk and more likely to stay out of prison. Now, that risk assessment currently is based on predominantly social factors. Social demographic factors are used for risk assessment. Well, if heart rate is so well replicated, could it be considered as yet another factor to be entered into the prediction equation to try and assess dangerousness within offenders? Again, there's no one factor that predicts crime and violence, not at all. Heart rate is predicting something, and it's predicting over and above social factors. So I've often wondered whether in the future, when we make risk assessments of prisoners to see how dangerous they are in terms of making decisions about probation, parole, whether this very simple and easy to assess biological measure, resting heart rate, could be incorporated into that equation and do a better job, a more accurate job of predicting future violence and crime.
Right. Yeah. No, that's fascinating. Is there anything else that you would like to add, anything that we haven't touched on that you think is important for understanding your research?
Well, I guess one point that Adrian mentioned earlier was that, well, you know, when we're talking about the cutoff points, males and females have different, you know, just different heart rates, resting heart rates over the lifetime. Of course, it decreases across the life course. But, you know, research has shown that we see these sex differences in heart rate as early as, like, newborns, really. Mm-hmm. So we see it in newborns from 0 to 7 days old, and also in individuals from 1 year, 1 year of age to up to about 79 years old. So the fact that we see these gender differences in heart rate so early in life, it suggests that, you know, there really is some value there in possibly explaining